As our hypothetical modern visitors wandered through the hurly-burly of construction and deconstruction, they might have felt that despite the commotion, something was missing. Unlike Western cities, Tiwanaku had no markets, no bazaars full of shouting, bargaining, conniving entrepreneurs, no street displays of produce, pottery, and plonk, no jugglers and mimes trying to attract crowds, no pickpockets. In Africa, Asia, and Europe, Colata wrote, a city was a place of meeting and of melding for many different kinds of people. Through trade and exchange, through buying and selling of every conceivable kind, the city was made and remade. Tiwanaku was utterly different. Andean societies were based on the widespread exchange of goods and services, but kin and government, not market forces, directed the flow. The citizenry grew its own food and made its own clothes, or obtained them through their lineages, or picked them up in government warehouses. And the city, as Colata put it, was a place for symbolically concentrating the political and religious authority of the elite. Other Andean cities, Wari among them, shared this quality, but Tiwanaku carried it to an extreme. Tiwanaku has been excavated for a century, and the more archaeologists delve into it, the less there seems to be. To Vranich, the capital's lack of resemblance to European imperial cities extends well beyond the absence of marketplaces. Far from being the powerful administrative center envisioned by earlier researchers, he says, Tiwanaku was a combination of the Vatican and Disneyland, a religious show capital with a relatively small population, almost a staff, that attracted pilgrims by the thousand. Like the tourists at the solstice today, visitors came to this empire of appearances to be dazzled and awed. In the central city, buildings and monuments went up and down, at an incredible rate, Vranich told me at Tiwanaku, where he had been working since 1996. Nothing ever got finished completely, because they were just concerned with the facades. They had to keep changing the exhibits to keep the crowds coming. The encounter between Tiwanaku and Wari at Cerro Baul seems to have gone remarkably smoothly. At any rate, a study of more than 1,000 Wari and Tiwanaku graves found no evidence of the trauma associated with violence. Instead, the two societies split the region between them. Wari camped atop Cerro Baul and a neighboring hillock, Cerro Mejia. Between them was a steep valley, with Tiwanaku settlements scattered throughout. Because Wari and Tiwanaku pottery differed, Williams and Nash have been able to map which group lived in which neighborhood by the distribution of ceramic fragments. The Wari Canal provided drinking water, but had to pass through Tiwanaku territory at the base of Cerro Baul. Tiwanaku let the water through, but took enough to irrigate more than 700 acres of terraces. At the same time, Wari and Tiwanaku kept themselves separate. Although they shared resources, there is little evidence that people from one culture visited the other often or had friendships across the political lines. Wari homes were furnished with Wari goods, Tiwanaku homes, Tiwanaku goods. Despite living next to each other, people continued to speak their different languages and wear their different clothing and look for inspiration and instruction from their different capitals. The social science word for such intermingling without intermixing is interdigitization. For two centuries at Cerro Baul, Wari and Tiwanaku were like people in parallel worlds, sharing the same time and space, but implacably separate from each other. It is a small reminder that Indians were neither the peaceful, love-thy-neighbor types envisioned by some apologists, or the brutal, ceaselessly aggressive warriors decried by some political critics.